Insidious fascination that grew stronger with the passage of time. Why France? Why Paris? The French language had always attracted me. I found it softer, more sensual than German, Spanish, or Italian. I used to give excellent imitations of the Looney Tunes' French skunk, Pepe Le Pew. But deep down, I knew my ever-growing ardor for Paris had nothing to do with the typical American clichés of romance, sophistication, and sexiness. It went beyond that. When I first discovered Paris, I was quickly drawn to its contrasts. Its tawdry, rough neighborhoods appealed to me as much as the Haussmannian, majestic ones. I craved its paradoxes, its secrets, its surprises. It took me 25 years to blend in, but I did it. I learned to put up with impatient waiters and rude taxi drivers. I learned to drive around the Place de l'Étoile, impervious to the insults yelled at me by irate bus drivers, and, more surprisingly, by elegant, highlighted blondes in shiny black minis. I learned how to tame arrogant concierges, snotty saleswomen, blasé telephone operators, and pompous doctors. I learned how Parisians consider themselves to be superior to the rest of the world, and specifically to all other French citizens living from Nice to Nancy, with a particular disdain toward the inhabitants of the City of Light suburbs. I learned how the rest of France nicknamed Parisians dog faces, with the rhyme Parisien tête de chien. Clearly, they were not overly fond of Parisians. No one loved Paris better than a true Parisian. No one was prouder of his city than a true Parisian. No one was half so arrogant, so haughty, so conceited, and quite so irresistible. Why did I love Paris so? I wondered. Maybe because it never gave in to me. It hovered enticingly close, yet it let me know my place. The American. I'd always be the American. L'Américaine. I knew I wanted to be a journalist when I was Zoe's age. I first started writing for the high school newspaper and had never stopped since. I came to live in Paris when I was a little over 20, after graduating from Boston University with an English major. My first job was as a junior assistant for an American fashion magazine. I soon left. I was looking for meatier topics than skirt lengths or spring colors. I took the first job that came up, rewriting press releases for an American TV network. It wasn't fantastically paid, but it was enough for me to stay on, living in the 18th arrondissement, sharing a place with two French gay men, Hervé and Christophe, who became long-lasting friends. That week, I had a dinner date with them at the Rue Berthe, where I'd lived before meeting Bertrand. Bertrand rarely accompanied me. I sometimes wondered why he was so uninterested in Hervé and Christophe. Because your dear husband, like most French bourgeois well-to-do gentlemen, prefers women to homosexuals, cocotte. I could almost hear my friend Isabelle's languid voice, her sly chuckle. Yes, she was right. Bertrand was definitely into women. Big time, as Charlo would say. Hervé and Christophe still lived in the same place I had shared with them, except that my small bedroom was now a walk-in closet. Christophe was a fashion victim, and proud of it. I enjoyed their dinners. There was always an interesting mix of people. A famous model or singer, a controversial writer, a cute gay neighbor, another American or Canadian journalist, or some young editor just starting out. Hervé worked as a lawyer for an international firm, and Christophe was a yoga teacher. They were my true dear friends. I did have other friends here, American expats, Holly, Susanna, and Jan, met through the magazine or the American College, where I often went to put up ads for babysitters. I even had a couple of close French girlfriends, like Isabelle, garnered through Zoe's ballet class at the Salle Pleyel. But Hervé and Christophe were the ones I called at 1 in the morning, when Bertrand had been difficult. The ones who came to the hospital when Zoe broke her ankle falling off her scooter. The ones who never forgot my birthday. The ones who knew which films to see, which records to buy. Their meals were invariably a delight, candlelit and exquisite. I arrived with a chilled bottle of champagne. Christophe was still in the shower, explained Hervé, greeting me at the door. In his mid-40s, Hervé was slim, mustachioed, and genial. He smoked like a chimney. It was impossible to get him to stop, so we had all given up.
That's a nice jacket, he commented,
putting down his cigarette to open the champagne. Hervé and Christophe always noticed what I was wearing, if I sported new perfume, new makeup, a new hairstyle. When I was with them, I never felt like l'Américaine, desperately trying to keep up with Parisian chic. I felt myself, and I love that about them.
That blue-green suits you, goes divinely with your eyes. Where did you buy it?
Hervé asked. H&M on the Rue de Rennes.
You look superb. So, how's the apartment coming along?
He asked, handing me a glass and some warm toast spread with pink tarama. There's a hell of a lot to be done, I sighed. It will take months.
And I imagine the architect of a husband is thrilled at the whole thing.
I winced. You mean he's indefatigable?
Ah, said Hervé. And therefore a pain in the ass for you.
You got it, I said, sipping champagne. Hervé looked at me closely through his tiny rimless glasses. He had pale gray eyes and ridiculously long eyelashes.
Say, Juju, he said, are you all right?
I smiled brightly. Yes, I'm fine. But fine was far from what I felt. My recent knowledge about the events of July 1942 had awakened a vulnerability within me, triggered something deep, unspoken, that haunted me, that burdened me. I had dragged that burden around with me all week, ever since I'd started to research the Veldive Roundup.
You just don't look yourself,
Hervé said, concerned. He came to sit next to me, putting his slim white hand on my knee.
I know that face, Julia. That's your sad face. Now, you tell me what's going on.
The only way to shut out the hell around her was to bury her head between her pointed knees and cup her hands over her ears. She rocked back and forth, pressing her face down onto her legs. Think of nice things. Think of all the things you like. Of all the things that make you happy. Of all those special, magical moments you remember. Her mother taking her to the hairdresser, and everyone complimenting her thick, honey-colored hair. You'll be proud of that head of hair later on, ma petite. Her father's hands working on the leather in the warehouse. How fast and strong they were. How she admired his skill. Her 10th birthday, and the new watch. The beautiful blue box. The leather strap her father had made, its rich, intoxicating smell, and the discreet tick-tock of the watch that fascinated her. She had been so proud. But Maman had said not to wear it to school. She might break it or lose it. Only her best friend Armel had seen it, and she had been so jealous. Where was Armel now? She lived just down the road. They went to the same school. But Armel had left the city at the beginning of the school vacations. She'd gone somewhere with her parents, somewhere south. There had been one letter, and that was all. Armel was small and red-haired and very clever. She knew all her multiplication tables by heart, and she even mastered the trickiest grammar. Armel was never afraid. The girl admired that about her. Even when the sirens went off in the middle of class, howling like enraged wolves, making everyone jump, Armel remained calm, in control. She would take the girl's hand and lead her down to the musty school cellar, impervious to all the other children's frightened whispers and Mademoiselle Dissot's quavering orders. And they would huddle together, shoulder to shoulder in the dark dampness, candlelight flickering on pale faces, for what seemed hours. and listened to the drone of the planes far above their heads, while Mademoiselle Dissot read Jean de La Fontaine or Molière, and tried to stop her hands from trembling. "Look at her hands," Armel would giggle. "She's afraid. She can hardly read. Look." And the girl would glance at Armel with wonder and whisper, "Aren't you afraid? Not even the tiniest bit." A contemptuous shake of glossy red curls. "No, I'm not. I'm not afraid." And sometimes, when the shudder of the bombs seeped through the grimy floor, making Mademoiselle Dissot's voice falter and stop, Armel would grab the girl's hand and hold it tight. She missed Armel. She wished Armel could be here now, to hold her hand and tell her not to be afraid. She missed Armel's freckles and her mischievous green eyes and her insolent grin. Think of the things you love, of the things that make you happy. Last summer, or was it 2 summers ago, she couldn't remember, Papa had taken them to spend a couple of days in the countryside by a river. She couldn't remember the name of the river. But the water had felt so smooth and wonderful to her skin. Her father had tried to teach her to swim. After a few days, she managed an inelegant dog paddle that made everybody laugh. By the river, her brother had gone mad with joy and excitement. He was tiny then, a mere toddler. She had spent the day running after him as he slipped and shrieked along the muddy shore. And Maman and Papa had looked so peaceful, young and in love, her mother's head against her father's shoulder. She remembered the little hotel by the water, where they had eaten simple, succulent meals beneath the cool, leafy bower. And when the patronne had asked her to help behind the counter, and there she was, handing out coffee and feeling very grown up and proud, until she dropped coffee on someone's foot. But the patronne had been very nice about it. The girl lifted her head, saw her mother talking to Eva, a young woman who lived near them. Eva had 4 young children, a bunch of rambunctious boys the girl wasn't overly fond of. Eva's face, like her mother's, looked haggard and old. How was it they looked so much older overnight, she wondered. Eva was Polish, too. Her French, like her mother's, was not good. Like the girl's mother and father, Eva had family back in Poland. Her parents, aunts, and uncles. The girl remembered the awful day. When was it? Not very long ago. When Eva had received a letter from Poland and she had turned up at the apartment, her face streaming with tears, and she'd broken down in her mother's arms. Her mother had tried to comfort Eva, but the girl could tell she was stricken as well. Nobody wanted to tell the girl exactly what had happened. The girl understood, hung on to every Yiddish word she could make out between the sobs. Something terrible. Back in Poland, entire families had been killed, houses burnt down, only ashes and ruins remained. She had asked her father if her grandparents were safe. Her mother's parents, the ones whose black and white photograph was on the marble mantelpiece in the living room. Her father had said that he did not know. There had been very bad news from Poland, but he wouldn't tell her what the news was. As she looked at Eva and her mother, the girl wondered if her parents had been right to protect her from everything, if they had been right to keep disturbing bad news away from her, if they had been right not to explain why so many things had changed for them since the beginning of the war. Like when Eva's husband never came back last year. He had disappeared. Where? Nobody would tell her. Nobody would explain. She hated being treated like a baby. She hated the voices being lowered when she entered the room. If they had told her, if they had told her everything they knew, wouldn't that have made today easier? "I'm fine, just tired, that's all. So who's coming tonight, then?" Before Hervé could answer, Christophe entered the room, a vision of Parisian chic, cocky in cream overtones, exuding expensive men's perfume. Christophe was a little younger than Hervé, tanned all year round, skinny, and wore his long salt-and-pepper hair tied back in a thick ponytail, a la Karl Lagerfeld. Almost simultaneously, the doorbell rang.
"Aha," said Christophe, blowing me a kiss. "That must be Guillaume."
He rushed to the front door. "Guillaume?" I mouthed at Hervé.
"Our new pal. Does something in advertising. Divorced. Bright boy, you'll like him. He's our only guest. Everyone else is out of town because of the long weekend."
The man who entered the room was tall, dark, in his late 30s. He was carrying a wrapped scented candle and roses.
"This is Julia Jarmont," said Christophe. "Our very dear journalist friend from a long, long time ago, when we were young."
"Which was merely yesterday,"
murmured Guillaume, in true gallant French fashion. I tried to keep an easy smile on my face, aware of Hervé's inquiring eyes moving to me from time to time. It was odd, because usually I would have confided in Hervé. I would have told him how strange I had been feeling for the past week, and the business with Bertrand. I'd always put up with Bertrand's provocative, sometimes downright nasty sense of humor. It had never hurt me. It had never bothered me. Until now. I used to admire his wit, his sarcasm. It had made me love him all the more. People laughed at his jokes. They were even a little afraid of him. Behind the irresistible laugh, the twinkling blue-gray eyes, the charming smile, was a tough, demanding man who was used to getting what he wanted. I had put up with it because he made up to me every time. Every time he realized he had hurt me, he showered me with gifts, flowers, and passionate sex. In bed was probably the only place Bertrand and I truly communicated, the only place where nobody dominated the other. I remember Charla saying to me once, after witnessing a particularly sharp tirade delivered by my husband, "Is this creep ever nice to you?" And watching my face slowly redden, "Jesus, I get the picture. Pillow talk. Actions speak louder than words." And she had sighed and patted my hand. Why hadn't I opened up to Hervé tonight? Something held me back. Something sealed my lips. Once seated around the octagonal marble table, Guillaume asked me what newspaper I worked for. When I told him, his face remained blank. I wasn't surprised. French people had never heard of Seine scenes. It was mostly read by Americans living in Paris. That didn't bother me. I had never craved fame. I was content with a well-paid job that kept my hours relatively free, despite Joshua's occasional despotism.
"And what are you writing about at the present?"
asked Guillaume politely, twisting green pasta around his fork. "The Veldiv," I said. "The 60th commemoration is coming up."
"You mean that roundup during the war?"
asked Christophe, his mouth full. I was about to answer him when I noticed that Guillaume's fork had stopped halfway between his plate and his mouth. "Yes, the big roundup at the Velodrome d'Hiver," I said.
"Didn't that take place somewhere out of Paris?"
Christophe went on, munching away. Guillaume had put his fork down, quietly. Somehow his eyes had locked onto mine. He had dark eyes, a sensitive fine mouth.
"It was the Nazis, I believe,"
said Hervé, pouring out more Chardonnay. Neither of them seemed to have noticed Guillaume's tight face.
"The Nazis who arrested Jews during the occupation."
"Actually, it wasn't the Germans," I began.
"It was the French police,"
interrupted Guillaume.
"And it happened in the middle of Paris, in a stadium which used to house famous bike races."
"Really?"
asked Hervé.
"I thought it was the Nazis in the suburbs."
"I've been researching this for the past week," I said. "German orders, yes, but French police action. Weren't you taught this in school?"
"I can't remember. I don't think so,"
admitted Christophe.
Guillaume's eyes looking at me again, as if he were drawing something out of me, probing me. I felt perturbed.
"It's quite amazing," said Guillaume with an ironic smile. "The number of French people who still don't know what happened. What about the Americans? Did you know about it, Julia?"
I did not avert my eyes. "No, I didn't know. And I wasn't told about it at school back in Boston in the 70s. But now I know a lot more. And what I've found out has overwhelmed me."
Hervé and Christophe remained silent.
They seemed at a loss, not knowing what to say. Guillaume finally spoke.
"In July 95, Jacques Chirac was the first president ever to draw attention to the role of the French government during the occupation, and toward this particular roundup. His speech made headlines. Do you remember it?"
I had read Chirac's speech during my recent research. He had certainly gone out on a limb. But I had not recalled it, although I must have heard it on the news 6 years ago. And the boys, I couldn't help calling them that, I always had, obviously had not read or remembered Chirac's speech. They gazed at Guillaume, embarrassed.
Hervé chain smoked and Christophe bit his nails, which he always did when he felt nervous or ill at ease.
Silence fell upon us. It was odd, silence in this room. There had been so many joyful, noisy parties here, people roaring with laughter, endless jokes, loud music, so many games, birthday speeches, dancing till the small hours, despite irate neighbors banging from underneath with a broom. The silence felt heavy and painful. When Guillaume started to speak again, his voice had changed. His face had changed, too. He was pale, and he could not look at us any longer. He stared down at his plate of untouched pasta.
"My grandmother was 15 the day of the roundup. She was told she was free, because they were only taking small children between 2 and 12 with their parents. She was left behind. And they took all the others. Her little brothers, her sister, her mother, her father, her aunt, her uncle, her grandparents. It was the last time she ever saw them. No one came back. No one at all."
The girl's eyes were glazed over at the ghastliness of the night. In the small hours, the pregnant woman had given birth to a premature, stillborn child. The girl had witnessed the screams, the tears. She saw the baby's head, mottled with blood, appear between the woman's legs. She knew she should be looking away, but she could not help staring. Appalled, fascinated. She saw the dead baby, gray and waxen, like a shrunken doll, promptly hidden behind a dirty sheet. The woman moaned constantly. No one could silence her. At dawn, her father had fished through the girl's pocket for the key to the secret cupboard. He took it and went to talk to a policeman. He brandished the key. He explained the situation. He was trying to remain calm, the girl could tell, but he was at the breaking point. He had to go and get his 4-year-old son, he told the man. He would return here, he promised. He would fetch his son and come straight back. But the policeman laughed in his face and sniggered.
"Do you think I'm going to believe you, my poor man?"
The father urged the man to come with him, to accompany him. He was just going to get the boy and come back immediately. The policeman ordered him out of the way. The father returned to his place. His shoulders stooped. He was crying. The girl took the key from his trembling hand and put it back into her pocket. How long could her brother survive, she wondered. He must still be waiting for her. He trusted her. He trusted her implicitly. She couldn't bear the idea of him waiting in the dark. He must be hungry. Thirsty. His water had probably run out, and the battery on the flashlight. But anything was better than here, she thought. Anything was better than this hell. The stink, the heat, the dust, the people screaming, the people dying.
she looked at her mother, crouched by herself, who hadn't uttered a whimper in the last couple of hours. She looked at her father, his face haggard, his eyes hollow. She looked around her, at Ava and her exhausted, pitiful boys, at all the other families, at all these unknown people who, like her, had yellow stars on their chests. She looked at the thousands of children running wild, hungry, thirsty, the little ones who could not understand, who thought it was some bizarre game that had gone on too long, and who wanted their homes, their beds, their teddy bears. She tried to rest, putting her pointed chin back onto her knees. The heat came again with the rising sun. She didn't know how she was going to face another day here. She felt weak, tired. Her throat was parched. Her stomach ached with emptiness. After a while, she dozed off. She dreamed she was back home, back in her little room overlooking the street, back in the living room where the sun used to shine through the windows and make patterns on the fireplace and on her Polish grandmother's photograph. And she would listen to the violin teacher play to her across the leafy courtyard. Sur le pont d'Avignon, on y danse, on y danse. Sur le pont d'Avignon, on y danse tout au rond. Her mother was making dinner, singing along. Les beaux messieurs font comme ça, et puis encore comme ça. Her brother was playing with his little red train down the long corridor, sliding it over the dark floorboards with a clatter and a bang. Les belles dames font comme ça, et puis encore comme ça. She could smell her home, its comforting scent of candle wax and spices, and all the tempting things cooking in the kitchen. She could hear her father's voice reading to her mother. They were safe. They were happy. She felt a cool hand on her forehead. She looked up to see a young woman wearing a blue veil branded with a cross. The young woman smiled at her and handed her a cup of fresh water, which she drank avidly. Then the nurse gave her a papery biscuit and some canned fish. "You must be brave," murmured the young nurse. But the girl saw that she, too, like the girl's father, had tears in her eyes.
"I want to get out," whispered the girl.
She wanted to go back to the dream, to the peace and safety she had felt. The nurse nodded. She smiled a tiny, sad smile.
"I understand. There's nothing I can do. I'm so sorry."
She got up, headed toward another family. The girl stopped her, grabbing her sleeve.
"Please, when are we going to leave?"
she asked. The nurse shook her head. She caressed the girl's cheek softly. Then she moved on to the next family. The girl thought she was going to go crazy. She wanted to scream and kick and yell. She wanted to leave this dreadful, hideous place. She wanted to go back home. Back to what her life had been before the yellow star. Before the men had banged on their door. Why was this happening to her? What had she done, or her parents done, to deserve this? Why was being Jewish so dreadful? Why were Jews being treated like this? She remembered the first day she'd worn her star to school. That moment when she had walked into the class and everybody's eyes had been drawn to it. A large yellow star, the size of her father's palm on her small chest. And then she saw that there were other girls in the class who had the star too. Armelle wore one as well. It had made her feel a little better. At recess, all the girls with the stars huddled together. They were pointed at by the other pupils, by all of those who used to be their friends. Mademoiselle Dissot had made a point of explaining that the star should not change anything. All the pupils were to be treated the same way as before, star or no star. But Mademoiselle Dissot's speech had not helped. From that day forward, most girls stopped speaking to the children with the stars, or worse still, stared at them with disdain. She could not stand the disdain. And that boy, Daniel, had whispered to her and Armel in the street, in front of the school, his mouth cruel and twisted.
"Your parents are dirty Jews. You are dirty Jews."
Why dirty? Why was being a Jew dirty? It made her feel ashamed, sad. It made her want to cry. Armel had said nothing, biting her lip till the blood came. It was the first time she'd seen Armel look afraid. The girl wanted to rip off the star. She told her parents she refused to go back to school with it. But her mother had said no, that she should be proud of it. She should be proud of her star. Her brother had thrown a fit because he too wanted a star. But he was under 6, explained his mother patiently. He'd to wait another couple of years. He had wailed all afternoon. She thought of her brother in the dark, deep cupboard. She wanted to take his hot little body in her arms, to kiss his curly blonde hair, his plump neck. She gripped the key as hard as she could in her pocket.
"I don't care what anybody says,"
she whispered to herself.
"I'll find a way to go back and save him. I'll find a way."
After dinner, Hervé offered us some limoncello, an ice-cold Italian liqueur made with lemon. It had a beautiful yellow color. Guillaume sipped his slowly. He had not said much during the meal. He seemed subdued. I did not dare bring the Veldive up again. But it was he who turned to speak to me as the others listened.
"My grandmother's old now," he said. "She won't talk about it anymore. But she told me everything I need to know. She told me everything about that day. I think the worst thing for her was having to live on without the others. To have to continue without them. Her entire family." I could not think of what to say. The boys were silent.
"After the war, my grandmother went to the Hotel Lutetia on the Boulevard Raspail every day," continued Guillaume. "That's where you had to go to find out if anyone had returned from the camps. There were lists and organizations. She went there every day and waited. But after a while, she stopped going. She began to hear about the camps. She began to understand that they were all dead, that no one would come back. Nobody had really known before. But then, the survivors returning and telling their stories, everybody knew."
Another silence.
"You know what I find most shocking about the Veldive?" Guillaume said. "It's code name."
I knew the answer to that, thanks to my extensive reading. "Operation Spring Breeze," I murmured.
"A sweet name, isn't it, for something so horrible?" he said. "The Gestapo had asked the French police to deliver a certain number of Jews, between 16 and 50 years old. The police were so intent on deporting the maximum number of Jews that they decided to ameliorate the orders. So they arrested all those little children, the ones born in France, French children."
"The Gestapo hadn't asked for those children?" I said.
"No," he replied, "not at first. Deporting children would have revealed the truth. It would have been obvious to all that Jews were not being sent to work camps, but to their deaths."
"So why were the children arrested?" I asked. Guillaume took a sip of his limoncello.
"The police probably thought that children of Jews, even if they were born in France, were still Jews. In the end, France sent nearly 80,000 Jews to the death camps.
Only a couple of thousand made it back. And hardly any of the children did." On the way home, I could not get Guillaume's dark, sad eyes out of my mind. He had offered to show me photographs of his grandmother and her family, and I had given him my phone number. He had promised to call me soon. Bertrand was watching television when I came in. He was lying flat out on the sofa, an arm under his head.
"So,"
he said,
barely taking his eyes off the screen.
How are the boys? Up to their usual standards of refinement?
I slipped off my sandals and sat on the sofa beside him, looking at his fine, elegant profile. A perfect meal. There was an interesting man, Guillaume.
Aha,
said Bertrand, looking at me, amused.
Gay?
No, I don't think so. But I never noticed that anyway.
And what was so interesting about this Guillaume guy?
He was telling us about his grandmother, who escaped the Veldif roundup back in 1942. He answered, changing channels with a remote control. Bertrand, I said, when you were at school, were you taught about the Veldif?
No idea, chérie.
That's what I'm working on now for the magazine. The 60th anniversary is soon. Bertrand picked up one of my bare feet and began to massage it with sure, warm fingers.
Do you think your readers are going to be interested in the Veldif?
He asked.
It's the past. It's not something most people want to read about.
Because the French are ashamed, you mean? I said. So we should bury it and move on like them? He took my foot off his knee, and the glint in his eye appeared. I braced myself.
My, my, he said, with a devilish grin. Yet another chance to show your compatriots how devious we French were, collaborating with the Nazis and sending those poor innocent families to their deaths. Little Miss Nahant bears the truth. What are you going to do, Amour? Rub our noses in it? Nobody cares anymore. Nobody remembers. Write about something else, something funny, something cute. You know how to do that. Tell Joshua the Veldif was a mistake. No one will read it. They'll yawn and turn to the next column.
I got up, exasperated. I think you're wrong, I seethed. I think people don't know enough about it. Even Christophe didn't know much about it, and he's French.
Bertrand snorted. Oh, Christophe can hardly read. The only words he deciphers are Gucci and Prada.
I left the room in silence, went into the bathroom and ran a bath. Why hadn't I told him to go to hell? Why did I put up with him again and again? Because you're crazy about him, right? Ever since you met him, even if he's bossy, rude, and selfish, he's clever, he's handsome, he can be so funny. He's such a wonderful lover, isn't he? Memories of endless sensual nights, kisses and caresses, crumpled sheets, his beautiful body, warm mouth, impish smile. Bertrand, so charming, so irresistible, so arduous. That's why you put up with him, isn't it? But for how long? A recent conversation with Isabel came back to me. Julia, do you put up with Bertrand because you're afraid of losing him? We were sitting in a small cafe by the Salle Pleyel while our daughters were attending ballet class, and Isabel had lit up her umpteenth cigarette and looked me straight in the eye. No, I had said, I love him, I really love him. I love the way he is. She'd whistled, impressed, but unconvinced. Well, lucky him then. But for God's sake, when he goes too far, tell him, just tell him. Lying in the bath, I remembered the first time I met Bertrand, in some quaint discotheque in Courcheval. He was with a group of loud, tipsy friends. I was with my then-boyfriend, Henry, whom I'd met a couple of months earlier at the TV network I worked for. We had a casual, easygoing relationship. Neither of us was deeply in love with the other. We were just two fellow Americans living it up in France. Bertrand had asked me to dance. It hadn't seemed to bother him at all that I was sitting with another man. Galled, I had refused. He'd been very insistent.
Oh, just one dance, miss. Only one dance. But such a wonderful dance, I promise you.
I glanced at Henry. Henry had shrugged.
Go ahead,
he had said, winking. So I got up and danced with the audacious Frenchman. I was rather stunning at 27.
And yes, I had been Miss Nahant when I was 17. I still had my rhinestone tiara tucked away somewhere. Zoe used to like playing with it when she was little. I've never been vain about my looks. But I had noticed that living in Paris, I got much more attention than on the other side of the Atlantic. I did also discover that French men were more daring, more overt when it came to flirting. And I also understood that despite the fact I had nothing of the sophisticated Parisian, too tall, too blonde, too toothy, my New England allure appeared to be just the flavor of the day. In the first months in Paris, I had been amazed at the way French men and women stare overtly at each other, sizing each other up constantly, checking out figures, clothes, accessories. I remembered my first spring in Paris and walking down the Boulevard Saint-Michel with Susanna from Oregon and Jan from Virginia. We weren't even dressed up to go out. We were wearing jeans, t-shirts, and flip-flops. But we were, all three of us, tall, athletic, blonde, and definitely American-looking. Men came up to us constantly.
Bonjour, mademoiselle. Vous êtes américaine, mademoiselle?
Young men, mature men, students, businessmen, endless men, demanding phone numbers, inviting us to dinner, to a drink, pleading, joking. Some charming, others much less charming. This did not happen back home. American men did not tag after girls on the street and declare their flame. Jan, Susanna, and I had giggled helplessly, feeling both flattered and dismayed. Bertrand says he fell in love with me during that first dance in the Courcheval nightclub, right then and there. I don't believe that. I think for him it came a little later. Maybe the next morning, when he took me skiing.
Merde alors!
French girls don't ski like that, he had panted, staring at me with blatant admiration. Like what? I had asked. They don't go half as fast, he had laughed, and kissed me passionately. However, I had fallen for him on the spot, so much so that I had hardly given poor Henry a departing look as I left the discotheque on Bertrand's arm. Bertrand talked almost immediately about getting married. It had never been my idea so soon. I was happy enough being his girlfriend for a while. But he had insisted, and he had been so charming and so amorous. I had finally agreed to marry him. I believe he felt I was going to be the perfect wife, the perfect mother. I was bright, cultivated, well-schooled, summa cum laude from Boston University, and well-behaved. For an American, I could almost hear him thinking. I was healthy and wholesome and strong. I didn't smoke, didn't take drugs, hardly drank, and believed in God. And so, back in Paris, I met the Tézac family. How nervous I had been on that first day. Their impeccable, classic apartment on the Rue de l'Université. Edouard's cold blue eyes, his dry smile. Colette and her careful makeup. Her perfect clothes. Trying to be friendly. Handing me coffee and sugar with elegant manicured fingers. And the two sisters. One was angular, blonde and pale. Laure. The other auburn, ruby-cheeked, and voluptuous. Cécile. Laure's fiancé, Thierry, was there. He hardly spoke to me. The sisters had both looked at me with apparent interest, baffled by the fact that their Casanova of a brother had picked out an unsophisticated American when he had Le Tout Paris at his feet. I knew Bertrand and his family, too, were expecting me to have 3 or 4 children in rapid succession. But the complications started right after our wedding. Endless complications that we had not expected. A series of early miscarriages had left me distraught. I managed to have Zoe after 6 difficult years. Bertrand hoped for a long time for number 2. So did I. But we never talked about it anymore. And then there was Amélie. But I certainly did not want to think about Amélie tonight. I'd done enough of that in the past. The bathwater was lukewarm, so I got out, shivering. Bertrand was still watching TV. Usually I would have gone back to him, and he would have held out his arms to me and crooned and kissed me, and I would have said he was just too rude. But I would have said it with a little girl voice and a little girl pout. And we would have kissed, and he would have taken me back to our room and made love to me. But tonight I did not go to him. I slipped into bed and read some more about the Veldief children. And the last thing I saw before I turned off the light was Guillaume's face when he had told us about his grandmother. How long had they been here? The girl could not remember. She felt deadened, numbed. The days had mingled with the nights. At one point, she had been sick, bringing up bile, moaning in pain. She had felt her father's hand upon her, comforting her. The only thing she had in mind was her brother. She could not stop thinking about him. She would take the key from her pocket and kiss it feverishly, as if kissing his plump little cheeks, his curly hair. Some people had died here during the past days, and the girl had seen it all. She had seen women and men go mad in the stifling, stinking heat and be beaten down and tied to stretchers. She had seen heart attacks and suicides and high fever. The girl had watched the bodies being carried out. She had never seen such horror. Her mother had become a meek animal. She hardly spoke. She cried. She prayed. One morning, curt orders were shouted through loudspeakers. They were to take their belongings and gather near the entrance. In silence, she got up, groggy and faint. Her legs felt weak. They could hardly carry her. She helped her father haul her mother to her feet. They picked up their bags. The crowd shuffled slowly to the doors. The girl noticed how everybody moved slowly, painfully. Even the children hobbled like old people, backs bent, heads down. The girl wondered where they were going. She wanted to ask her father, but his closed, thin face meant she was not going to get an answer now. Could they be going home at last? Was this the end? Was it over? Would she be able to go home and free her brother? They walked down the narrow street, the police ordering them on. The girl glanced at the strangers watching them from windows, balconies, doors, from the sidewalk. Most of them had empty, uncompassionate faces. They looked on, not saying a word. "They don't care," thought the girl. "They don't care what is being done to us, where we are being taken to." One man laughed, pointing at them. He was holding a child by the hand. The child was laughing too. "Why?" thought the girl. "Why? Do we look funny with our stinking, wretched clothes? Is that why they are laughing? What is so funny? How can they laugh? How can they be so cruel?" She wanted to spit at them, to scream at them. A middle-aged woman crossed the street and quickly pressed something into her hand. It was a small roll of soft bread. The woman was shooed off by policemen. The girl just had enough time to see her return to the other side of the street. The woman had said, "You poor little girl. May God have pity." What was God doing? Thought the girl dully. Had God given up on them? Was he punishing them for something she did not know about? Her parents were not religious, although she knew they believed in God. They had not brought her up in the traditional religious fashion, like Armel had been by her parents, respecting all the rites. The girl wondered whether this was not their punishment for not practicing their religion well enough. She handed the bread to her father, and he told her to eat it. She wolfed it down too fast. It nearly choked her. They were taken in the same town buses to a railway station overlooking the river. She didn't know which station it was. She'd never been there before. She had rarely left Paris in all her 10 years. When she saw the train, she felt panic overcome her. No, she couldn't leave. She had to stay.
She had to stay because of her brother. She had promised to come back to save him. She tugged on her father's sleeve, whispering her brother's name. Her father looked down at her.
There is nothing we can do, he said with helpless finality. Nothing.
She thought of the clever boy who had escaped, the one who had gotten away. Anger swept through her. Why was her father being so weak, so gutless? Did he not care about his son? Did he not care about his little boy? Why didn't he have the courage to run away? How could he just stand there and be led into a train like a sheep? How could he just stand there and not break away, and not run back to the apartment and the boy and to freedom? Why didn't he take the key from her and run away? Her father looked at her, and she knew he read all the thoughts in her head. He told her very calmly that they were in great danger. He did not know where they were being taken. He did not know what was going to happen to them. But he did know that if he tried to escape now, he would be killed. Shot down instantly in front of her, in front of her mother. And if that happened, that would be the end. She and her mother would be alone. He had to stay with them, to protect them. The girl listened. He had never used this voice with her before. It was the voice she had overheard during those worrying secret conversations. She tried to understand. She tried not to let her face show her anguish. But her brother. It was her fault. She was the one who had told him to stay in the cupboard. It was all her fault. He could have been here with them now. He could have been here, holding her very hand, if it hadn't been for her. She began to cry, burning tears that scalded her eyes, her cheeks.
I didn't know,
she sobbed.
Papa, I didn't know. I thought we were coming back. I thought he'd be safe.
Then she looked up at him, fury and pain in her voice, and pummeled her little fists against his chest.
You never told me, Papa. You never explained. He never told me about the danger, never. Why? You thought I was too small to understand, didn't you? You wanted to protect me. Is that what you were trying to do?
Her father's face. She could no longer look at it. He gazed down at her with such despair, such sadness. Her tears washed the image of his face away. She cried into her palms, alone. Her father did not touch her. In those awful lonely minutes, the girl understood. She was no longer a happy little 10-year-old girl. She was someone much older. Nothing would ever be the same again. For her, for her family, for her brother. She exploded one last time, tugging on her father's arm with a violence that was new to her.
He's going to die! He will die!
We are all in danger, he replied at last. You and me. Your mother, your brother Ava and her sons and all these people, everyone here. I am here with you, and we are with your brother. He is in our prayers, in our hearts.
Before she could answer, they were pushed into a train that had no seats, just bare wagons. A covered cattle train. It smelled rank and dirty. Standing near the doors, the girl looked out to the gray, dusty station. On a nearby platform, a family was waiting for another train. The father, the mother, and two children. The mother was pretty, her hair done up in a fancy bun. They were probably off on vacation. There was a girl just her age. She had a pretty lilac dress. Her hair was clean, her shoes shiny. The two girls gazed at each other from across the platform. The pretty, fancied-haired mother was looking, too. The girl in the train knew her tearful face was black with filth, her hair greasy. But she did not bow her head with shame. She stood straight, her chin high. She wiped away the tears. And when the doors were heaved closed, when the train gave a jolt, wheels clanging and groaning, she peered out through a tiny chink in the metal.
she never stopped looking at the little girl. She watched until the figure in the lilac dress completely disappeared.
I had never been fond of the 15th arrondissement, probably because of the monstrous surge of high-rise modern buildings that disfigured the banks of the Seine just next to the Eiffel Tower, and that I had never been able to get used to, although they were built in the early 70s, a long while before I arrived in Paris. But when I turned up at the Rue Nélaton with Bamber, where the Vélodrome d'Hiver once stood, I thought to myself, I liked this area of Paris even less.
"God-awful street,"
muttered Bamber. He took a couple of shots with his camera. The Rue Nélaton was dark and silent. It obviously never got much sunshine. On one side, bourgeois stone buildings built in the late 19th century. On the other, where the Vélodrome d'Hiver used to be, a large brownish construction, typically early 60s, hideous in both color and proportion. "Ministère de l'Intérieur," read the sign above the revolving glass doors.
"Odd place to build governmental offices," remarked Bamber. "Don't you think?"
Bamber had only found a couple of existing photographs of the Veldiv. I held one of them in my hand. Big black lettering read, "Veldiv," against a pale facade. A huge door. A cluster of buses parked along the sidewalk. And the tops of people's heads. Probably taken from a window across the street on the morning of the roundup. We looked for a plaque for something that mentioned what had happened here, but could not find it. "I can't believe there's nothing," I said. We finally found it on the Boulevard de Grenelle, just around the corner. A smaller sign, rather humble. I wondered if anyone ever glanced at it. It read, "On July 16th and 17th, 1942, 13,152 Jews were arrested in Paris and the suburbs, deported, and assassinated at Auschwitz. In the Vélodrome d'Hiver that once stood on the spot, 1,129 men, 2,916 women, and 4,115 children were packed here in inhuman conditions by the government of the Vichy police, by order of the Nazi occupant. May those who tried to save them be thanked. Passerby, never forget."
"Interesting," mused Bamber. "Why so many children and women and so few men?"
"Rumors of a big roundup had been circulating," I explained. "There had already been a couple before, especially in August of 1941. But so far, only men were arrested. And they hadn't been as vast, as minutely planned as this one. That's why this one is infamous. The night of July 16th, most of the men went into hiding, thinking the women and the children would be safe. That's where they were wrong."
"How long had it been planned for?"
"For months," I answered. "The French government had been working on it intently since April 42, writing up all the lists of the Jews to arrest. Over 6,000 Parisian policemen were commissioned to carry it out. At first, the initial chosen date was July 14th, but that's the national fete here, so it was scheduled a little later." We walked toward the metro station. It was a dismal street. Dismal and sad.
"And then what?"
asked Bamber.
"Where were all these families taken?"
"Penned in the Veldie for a couple of days. A group of nurses and doctors were finally let in. They all described chaos and despair. Then the families were taken to Austerlitz station and then on to the camps around Paris, and then sent straight to Poland." Bamber raised an eyebrow.
"Camps? You mean concentration camps in France?"
"Camps that are considered the French antechambers to Auschwitz. Drancy, that's the one closest to Paris, and Pithiviers and Beaune-le-Roland."
"I wonder what they look like today, these places," said Bamber. "We should go there and find out."
"We will," I said.
We stopped at the corner of the Rue Nélaton for a coffee. I glanced at my watch. I had promised to go see ma mère today. I knew I wouldn't make it. Tomorrow, then. It was never a chore for me. She was a grandmother I had never had. Both of mine had passed away when I was a small child. I just wished Bertrand would make more of an effort, considering she doted upon him. Bamber dragged me back to the Veldif.
"Sure makes me glad I'm not French," he said.
Then he remembered.
"Oops, sorry. You are now, aren't you?"
"Yes," I said. "By marriage, I have dual nationality."
Didn't mean what I said," he coughed.
He looked embarrassed. "Don't worry," I smiled. "You know, even after all these years, my in-laws still call me the American." Bamber grinned.
"Does that bother you?"
I shrugged. "Sometimes. I've spent more than half of my life here. I really feel I belong here."
"How long have you been married?"
"It will soon be 16 years. But I've been living here for 25.
"Oh, did you have one of those posh French weddings?"
I laughed. "No, it was simple enough. In Burgundy, where my in-laws have a house. Near Saint." I fleetingly remembered that day. There had not been a great deal exchanged between Sean and Heather Jarmond, and Edward and Colette Tizac. It seemed like the entire French side of the family had forgotten their English. But I hadn't cared. I was so happy. Brilliant sunshine. The quiet little country church. My simple ivory dress that my mother-in-law approved of. Bertrand stunning in his gray morning coat. The dinner party at the Tizacs, beautifully done. Champagne, candles, and rose petals. Charla delivering a very funny speech in her terrible French, and that only I had laughed at. Laure and Cécile simpering. My mother, and her pale magenta suit, and her little whisper in my ear. "I do hope you'll be happy, Angel Pie." My father waltzing with the stiff-backed Colette. It seems so long ago.
"Do you miss America?"
Bamber asked. "No, I miss my sister, but not America." A young waiter came to bring us our coffees. He took one look at Bamber's flame-colored hair and smirked. Then he saw the impressive arrays of cameras and lenses.
"You tourists?" he asked. "Taking nice photos of Paris?"
"Not tourists, just taking nice photos of what's left of the Veldiv," said Bamber in French, with his slow British accent.
The waiter seemed taken aback.
"Nobody asks about the Veldiv much," he said. "The Eiffel Tower, yes, but not the Veldiv."
"We're journalists," I said. "We work for an American magazine."
Sometimes there are Jewish families who come in here," recalled the young man. "After one of the anniversary speeches at the memorial down by the river."
I had an idea. "You wouldn't know of anybody, a neighbor on this street, who knows about the roundup, who could talk to us?" I asked. We had already spoken to several survivors. Most of them had written books about their experience. But we were lacking witnesses. Parisians who had seen all this happen. Then I felt silly. After all, the young man was barely 20. His own father probably wasn't even born in 42.
Yes, I do, he answered to my surprise. If you walk back up the streets, you'll see a newspaper store on your left. The man in charge there, Javier, he'll tell you. His mother knows, she's lived there all her life.
We left him a large tip. There had been an endless dusty walk from the little train station, through a small town, where more people had stared and pointed. Her feet ached. Where were they going now? What was going to happen to them? Were they far from Paris? The train ride had been fast, barely a couple of hours. As always, she thought of her brother. Her heart sank lower with each mile they covered. How was she ever going to get back home? How was she going to make it? It made her feel sick to think he probably thought she'd forgotten him.
That's what he believed. Locked up in the dark cupboard. He thought she had abandoned him. That she didn't care. That she didn't love him. He had no water. No light. And he was afraid. She'd let him down. Where were they? She hadn't had time to look at the name of the station as they had pulled in. But she had noticed the first things a city child pays attention to. The lush countryside. The flat green meadows. The golden fields. The intoxicating smell of fresh air in summer. The hum of a bumblebee. Birds in the sky. Fluffy white clouds. After the stinking heat of the past few days, this was glorious, she felt. Maybe it wasn't going to be that bad after all. She followed her parents through barbed wire gates, with stern-looking guards on each side holding guns. And then she saw the rows of long, dark barracks, the grimness of the place, and her spirit sank. She cowered against her mother. Policemen started to shout orders. The women and children were told to go to the sheds on the right, the men on the left. Helpless, holding on to her mother, she watched her father be pushed along with a group of men. She felt afraid without him by her side, but there was nothing she could do. The guns terrified her. Her mother did not move. Her eyes were dulled, dead. Her face was white.